So the bulk of Shear, the next, I think probably up until Tisha B'Av, it's possible we'll finish earlier, but I'm not so optimistic. We're going to forget that we're a high-flying philosophic Shear, and we're really just going to read the primary Torah. Going through Rav Zevin and Rav Israeli, I was very careful, I think, never to offer any evaluation of their reading of the primary Sugyot. Right, you'll know, I spent all my time talking about their readings of everything around the primary sugya of Adam Chavil Bat Noah and Hakaza, because I wanted to leave us, right, because that sugya, which bottom line seems to be core to almost everybody, I want to read independently. So I really, I think that the just following what goes on the basic level is really quite hard. I haven't succeeded in doing it yet, so I'm happy to just read with you and we'll see what comes out. I do want to just offer one thing before I forget it, as a fun analogy that I thought of on the issue of who owns what, which is photographs of celebrities. So let's suppose I take a photograph, or even a private people, right? Let's suppose I take a photograph of Rachel. Rachel's always my take a photograph of Rachel, and I wish to right, and then I wish to utilize this photograph in an advertisement for non-biodegradable plastic plates. Right? So now that would not be legal, even though I own the photograph, because Rachel owns her image.
She's very concerned with it.
And therefore. Right. So I wonder if you can't do some kind of analogy to the relationship between God, human beings, and their bodies. That while we may own the specific body, the body we have is the image of God. Right. And God has a reasonable proprietary interest in His image. Right. And so we can think about how that might affect the. It would certainly create. You can certainly understand how that would create a prohibition against Chilul Hashem, right? Using it, right? And maybe there are other ways in which we can, I think that's the clearest illustration of that is Kilat Elohim Taloi in the Midrash, which I forget who mentioned over Shabbos, or the Midrash, that the reason you can't leave a body hanging is because people will say that right there, that's the king hanging there. Right? That's a clear case where it's not that the king, right? The king doesn't own his brother's body. Right? Somebody else may have bought the brother's body. You can't leave it hanging there because it has an impact on the king's image. Right? So I want to set that up as, and it may be that the model of Shutfus, right, is a crude model, where God and human beings relate to the body in the exact same way, and then we just have to figure out what happens to the majority ownership, right? And those kind of issues. Right? That may not be the most productive way to engage in it. It may be that talking about different types of relationships is more productive. So I offer this as one model for what a different model in which both God and human beings have interests in their bodies, but not because they're partners, and because they have different interests. Yes, David?
You're assuming philosophically that our body is the image of God. If I assume that the image of God refers to our soul, that metaphor has no meaning.
No. The word image is a pun there. Right? The human being in its entirety in some way, right, represents God on earth. I think that's the way to frame it, right? The word image in the most literal sense of the image, right, the one that would make Yair Lorberbaum happy, right, really physical, right, we look like God, right, that kind of thing, which is, not really comfortable theologically, right? Kibbeyachol, right, I'll throw Kibbeyachol in. I say that's the most fun way to make this argument, is to take it that literally. I don't think it takes that much. If you want to say, let's say those of us who are comfortable with Jewish exceptionalism, we say Jews are God's nation on earth, and so whatever Jews do, right, represents God. Doesn't say anything about Selim. Okay, I don't think I need that. I mean, that was just fun. Yes, Chan.
What do you think as far as voice?
As a voice.
Right, you're saying if you take a photograph with her, it's within her ownership, because you think a little voice, it's a different thing, such as, Michael Jackson bought the rights to the songs of the Beatles. process.
Yeah, I think that.
Or you can look at like Little Mermaid, you know, and like.
Sure. Those are all proprietary, right?
But are we thinking of? Would you argue that a voice is an extension?
Sure.
Of the body.
Yeah, I don't even know that need bodies for this, but sure, right? You know, God, if your voice if in any way people will conflate what you do with what God wants,
mm-hmm.
then God has a legitimate interest in what you do. Not that he owns you, he just has an interest, because in Mela, what you do affects him. And sometimes we say that your autonomy interests override other people's interests, and sometimes they don't, right? So my autonomous interest in throwing my baseball where I want does not extend to throwing it through your window. Right, because you have an interest in having your glass broken. Right? So God has a legitimate interest in it, right? In how he is perceived. That's the argument I want to make. Again, I don't think that's a final analogy. I think that there's room for lots of Lamdanim and poets to try and explore exactly what it means. I want to move us beyond partnership as the only model. Okay. So with that, let's move to discussing this really interesting subject. So we'll start with this background issue. So far as I know, in my Kabbalah and the academic world, is that the individual Mishnah does not exist. The only unit in of Mishnah, the smallest unit of Mishnah that exists, is the Perek. And the division into individual Mishnayot is a printer's convenience, and much later. And therefore, if you want to look at a Mishnah in literary context, you have to look at the whole chapter together. Yes, David.
It predates the printing press, the individual Mishnayot. If you look at the manuscripts of the Perek Mishnayot from the Rambam, he had individual Mishnayot.
Yeah, scribes can be. The Rambams are different than ours, right? No one I think argues that the Mishnayot, as we have them broken up, represent literary units that were consciously intended to have beginnings and ends. Chapters were constructed. Right, individual Mishnah, right? Now, the chapters are composed of smaller units, but those smaller units, right, may or may not correspond to what is set up, which, for example, in Vilnishas, I think is most... The idea of dividing into sections predates printing. Right? But the particular division we have is just a mnemonic. Right? Most manuscripts have the full chapter of Mishnah and the full chapter of Gemara. And often the full chapter of Mishnah is written on the side, and the Gemara is written around it. The problem with that is that the Gemara doesn't come with markers of which line, intrinsically, of which line you're talking about. So you have a Gemara that begins, Minohane Mili, which Mili? Right? So sometimes most of the time we put in these little piskaot as the marker, but that works great if you still have the Mishnah in your head. But if the Mishnah was 5 pages back, right, you have to start hunting for the piskah. So we put in a longer piskah as a subheading, and then we put a one-line reference to that short piskah in the middle. Okay, but the single Mishnah really is a fiction. Yes, right.
Oh, no.
Okay, right. That's a premise I'm going to work at. What the nature of the chapter is a more complicated question that I think Avi Wolfish is the one who does who does most of the work. In some places, it's really interesting, like trying to explain. You know, I think Rosh Hashanah is a place where it is really interesting. You can see that Prakim and, for particular literary reasons, it's great parallelism and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
As you all know, like, you know, in Gemara, you know, you want to end the Sefer on high notes and things like that. Right. Okay, yes, Jan.
If you're so concerned with the integrity, just put all of the Mishnah together, why would you put in Nikudot, punctuation, and line spacing?
Ah, so this is it, right? So now I bias you, but... I bias you by formatting.
You try to a lot of the when you picked up the Gemara.
Good. You are more than free to overcome that. I always have to choose between efficiency. You know, it would be between efficiency and the ideal. You are always more than welcome to ignore my right to just look at the first word and the last word. For those of you who find it frustrating and won't get through it in time, so I figured I'd give you my bias. But you should be aware that sometimes they're pedagogically misleading, like Trump. So I'll get thrown a fun sideboard. Beginning of Echa. Echa Yeshua Zadi Rabbasiyam Haisal Kalmana. Rabbasiyam Agoyim Sarasiyam Dino Taitelamas. That's the Trump, right? Yeah, yeah. Echa Yeshua Zadi Rabbasiyam Haisal Kalmana. Right?
Now, let's see if I can address it. It's awful. It's an awful pasuk. All right, if you're trying to recite it. That has the rhythm of a one-winged bird or whatever. It just doesn't. But if you say Echa Yeshav Adari Ira Batiam Haytak Almanah Rabativa Goyim Zarati Yom Dinot Haytalamas. Oh, right, that rolls trippingly off the tongue. Right, it's three. Right, it's divided into three units. Each of them talks about right what has become. So the question there is, why is the trap so awful? Right, why didn't we put that? Right, why isn't it Echa Yeshav Adari Ira Bat? That would make sense. So I think it's actually deliberate, and the point of it is actually the structure of the first pasuk is designed to get you to move from the personal to the political and to see the political as personal, and the way you do that is by changing the meaning of the word rabasi, because you start off by saying I saw Yeshav Adari Ira Bat Yam I saw Kalmana. And you think that Haysak Almanah is an emotional condition. Right? Rabasi V'am Haysak Almanah means the city which once had lots of people is now sitting as a widow. Right? Now sitting as a widow alone. Right? It's a very emotional image. It's the wrong emotional image. You just think about it immediately. Because you were thinking about a city which once had lots of people and now doesn't, and now is alone. What should the image be? Not an Almanah, but a...
No,
the opposite. A Shakula. Right, it should be a mother who's lost her children, not a woman who's lost one husband. But an almanah is a very powerful political image. An almanah is powerless. So, right, there's really a Taisak almanah rabasiv agoyim. The one who was once the greatest of nations has now become like a widow. But the trap has you first perceive Taisak almanah as an emotional condition. And then when you reread the pasuk, you realize that it's actually a political condition, and so it actually the misreading functions beautifully to make the point of the pasuk, I think. So be aware of this. Sometimes my formatting may similarly be designed to mislead you. Yes, David.
It's about me. It's not really.
Okay. So with that, but you are entitled and encouraged to go straight to Gemara and ignore my formatting. I do it as a public service and. Sometimes it might be useful to do it that way and go back and say, gee, why did he do it that way? So I'm starting with the premise that if we want to understand what's going on here, the unit we worked with is the chapter. And the question I ask is, what does this chapter say about whether the payment for boshet is standard, meaning it is, for my perspective, independent of the persons involved? Or differentiated, meaning that it depends on the person's involved. Obviously, it depends on what you do to the person and how badly you embarrass them, in an objective sense, right? It should cost more to throw a pie that leaves a permanent stain at somebody than to throw a pie that just puts whipped cream on it they can lick off or something. Whatever your standards are, I will leave Deirdre's expertise on exactly what pies. I read something once on the types of pies and how. There's a whole thing because there's some pie-throwing political activists, and they actually carefully calibrate the kind of pie they throw at particular politicians, depending on how seriously they object to their policies. But I believe that to others more expert than I to determine. Okay, so Mishnah begins. Right, with a statement that Chovel b'chaviro is chayav for five things. It gives a list of each of the five and how you pay. Each of them come with cases. Right, tell us how to measure them. And the last one on the list is boshet. Okay, and boshet it tells us. Right, the standard is, as opposed to all the others. Right, the standard for boshet is a kol lefi hamivayish v'hamitvayish. Right, again, all the others, so far as we can tell, the only thing we change is the injury. Although, you have to figure out, because some people are worth more as slaves and some people are worth less as slaves, And some people's status as slaves depends on other things, yes.
You could say the same thing about Tsar. Different people might pay different amounts to avoid pain. That is true.
Adam Kayotebeza. That's true. So that's overstated. All of it, what I would say is that bullshit is the only one that has a rhetorical statement that is differentiated. Right, I think that would be, right? Maybe Adam Kazeh is also. Bullshit is in your face. Hakol lefi ha-mivayesh ve-ha-mitvayesh. Okay, so, let's say, Yedidia. So when you read that line, what did you think it meant?
That there was a general spectrum up and down.
Yeah. So every case is different.
Yeah.
Right, bullshit is an utterly differentiated standard.
A relativized.
Okay, right, everything, right? And that, I think that's a really reasonable, you know, obvious reading, right? That tells us bullshit is as opposed to the others, bullshit is case by case. Really clearly case by case. Yes, Sylvia.
Yeah, so the alternative reading would be that Akolafim Yavesh Amit Bayesh is only referring to the next line of the Mishnah. In other words, Yashin versus not Yashin. Or basically, it depends on whether the Mivayesh had intent, but not whether the Mivayesh had intent. Which is a difficult reading, because actually it doesn't depend on the Mivayesh, it only depends on the Mivayesh.
It's a very difficult
reading. But it seems to be introducing those halakhos.
Okay. So let's write the narrower thing is
the Mishnah, which then would make more sense, because it is what they have in Mivayesh, not Mivayesh.
And I think a narrower way of making Soviet's point is that Hakol Lefi Yavesh Mitbayesh is followed by a series of cases, and we have to ask ourselves, what is the relationship between those cases and the rule? Okay, so one possibility is that those cases define the rule, but it's challenging to figure out how those cases define the rule. Now, particularly, as pointed out, since there are no examples in which the Mitbayesh makes a difference. Okay, good. Okay, then we have a tangent about the difference or non-difference between people and oxen. We now have, but it's not true. Right, there's a Homer by Adam, for sure. Okay. Sorry. I didn't make Yeshivish jokes here. It's been all year again, like waiting for the audience to look at Yeshivish jokes.
Got it.
Yeah.
Just one thing on the relationship between Homer and Baruch and the examples. If there were a relationship, it should seem that relationship should be something that implies differentiation, not in terms of Tiyub and Ptur, but actually the amount of money, and there's nothing like that here.
Okay, right, so you're right, that since nothing is mentioned about money, we'd have to change the Yesh Mit Bayesh to talk about the person as opposed to the amount, and just, right, it all depends on the intent, that's what Tiyub tries.
Right.
But we all agree that's forced, but unless it's something, we have to be compelled to do that. Okay, we have...
Unless you don't indent that line there.
And then, it's just, if you don't indent the line, then it's not explained those cases.
Right.
And it's no relationship at all. The unit ended at Kol, right? And that's reasonable. A reasonable reading is that the first literal unit is you're chayav for five things. Here are the five things. And now we're going to talk about one of those five things, unrelated to the previous line. No literary connection. Absolutely correct. Possible. Absolutely. Indenting is a very tricky error. And I don't know that I got it right. Okay. So then, Omer Badami Bashor, fine. Right? We have that line. Then we have a unit which has an interesting unit, interesting structure of all of it, where it talks about parents, and then it talks about Evid, then it talks about various people who are at whose responsibility is lowered, right? Shota, Katan, Evid, and Isha, and then it goes back to Maki Aviv, right? There's a sort of chiastic structure there. The only thing that matters for our topic is Rabbi Yehuda's claim that Ein Lavadim Boshet. If you can find a way to connect that, you know, maybe that's the Mitbayesh. You know, if you really want to do that. I'm not convinced, but I have to say it exists. Fine. What matters to me, the next thing that matters is the line, right, the Citro, Notendo Matayim, Takela Kaver Notin Losella,
the conflicting position of the mana, citra no tan lama taimzuz, lachar yado, no tain lo arbameyazuz, sarambe az no, talash besaro, rakat vigev roko, hevir talatoyenu, hara rosha isha bashuk, no tain arbameyazuz.
So, again, we're just reading that line naively. If we saw that line, it says if you do X to Y, you pay Z. Right? Does that sound like it depends on any factors other than what you did and whom you did it to?
No. Right. So we are now left. We have line number one, which says a kol lefiham avayesh from itbayesh, and line two gives us fixed amounts for a specific fixed amounts of bushet for a specific action. Okay.
Now nobody bothers to tell us that these are different people. So we probably have a bias towards reconciling this if we want. Right, probably have a bias because it's all anonymous and nobody's told us anything. But we don't really know offhand how we would reconcile this. This is followed by a line which says it's happily that well. A kol lefi chvodo. Okay, so Vididia, what does that line mean? Zehakwal
hakol lefi chvodo. I mean, I feel like the simple reading is just ended. You have to take everything we just said here with a grain of salt, because it can go up or down really depending on your the status of the person.
Okay, so you want to claim that Zehakwal is intent. Now, we'll start with, so in your experience, what does the word Zehakwal mean in Tantric literature?
It means that it's the general rule given that expands wider than the individual cases we just enumerated.
Aha. But you remember any case where we say where the term Zehakel is intended to contradict the previous examples?
Right.
Not generally.
This would be an exception to that.
Ah, okay. This would be the clause that you can't be lomid in a clause. Right. Alright, Tom, what do you want to say?
I'd like to suggest that Zehakal was talking about, here are some, the previous lines are benchmarks, if you will, and Zehakal was saying, particular cases are addressed here, you can use these as benchmarks to evaluate, should it be higher than 200, should it be lower than 200, 400, etc., and then when you go back to Mivayesh and Mivayesh, so that also can throw in additional factors of socioeconomic status, where we would have these base cases, the benchmark cases, referring to, with the most simple reading being normal Balabayit with a normal Balabayit.
But you think what you're going to claim is that the amounts represent something like a reasonable bystander standard. Right? That this is what an ordinary person who is embarrassed by an ordinary person should say, right? So that, right, it's the median, so to speak, or something like that.
Okay.
Hold on one second. And then Zachal Kolonchifodo tells me, but the rule is that all of these are adjustable.
Not for the normal bystander case, but rather if there are other factors which, again, are not exactly as the parameters before, then how are you supposed to evaluate?
Well, we haven't had any parameters before.
Mm-hmm.
What parameters before?
The parameters before of this is Sarambeo's no, or Talash Saro. This is the kind of damage that was done.
Right. So if a person of great dignity has somebody walk up to them and tweak their nose.
Yeah.
Right. Do they pay the amount in the Mishnah? Or
so it could be that Zehakal is disregarding.
Okay, so we just point out this is where we said that so far as I know you did is right, the Zehakal is always intended to say that previous examples illustrate the following rule. And what you're saying is that this rule is intended to prevent you from generalizing the previous examples. The exception. The previous examples would tell you here's a standard amount. We're saying even though there is a standard amount, you should be aware that the rule is that they can be adjusted.
You're saying that that's how I'm reading it?
That sounds like how you're reading it, right?
That's not what I mean. What I mean is these are, if you have a case of Saran Bale's no,
right.
It's 400, period. Talash Yisrael, 400, period, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now this isn't a comprehensive list.
Aha. So,
you're
saying that if someone is Saran Bale's no,
yeah.
Then it does. Then it's not, in that case, no matter who you are and either party is, those amounts are fixed. The Zehakal comes to tell me in cases that are not listed in the Mishnah, it's variable?
If we're reading it independently from Mishnah Aleph, yes, that's how I read it.
Okay, so I'm pointing again. So then Zehakal is divorced from any examples. There are no examples related to Zehakal.
Right.
No, I'm saying that Klal is directly related to the examples prior in Mishnah Vav.
Examples prior in Mishnah Vav.
All these examples are
Mishnah
Vav. Mishnah Vav. Then you have that Klal and Mishnah Vav. The
only no, 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 I don't know anything about Mishnah Vav. Don't use number letters to me.
Okay,
that Klal, tell me what example is what example does the Klal Hakol Lefi Chodo illustrate? What previously mentioned? What previously a klal is
okay.
Supposed to right or expand, right? So
expand, yes.
Expand. So what examples? In what previous cases was it a kol lefi chvodo that we can now expand? So what, where are there cases mentioned previous in the Mishnah as a kol lefi chvodo?
Starting from the word staro.
The word staro.
Yes.
Okay, lama time zuz.
Etc. Yes.
I see. Do you want to say a kol lefi chvodo means? To the extent to which he is embarrassed, not the personality.
Right. Correct.
Ah, okay. So remember, Hakol Adichodo means does not mean Hakol Adichodo Mivayesh Vamitvayesh.
Correct.
Hakol Adichodo means the rule is it all depends on how much you, and how much a normal person would be embarrassed by these actions.
Correct.
Okay. Good. I get that.
Okay.
Okay. So now, is that the way you read it, Edu?
What?
Is that the way you read it?
No, I think you can read it that way too, but the thing is, you then run into trouble then with what exactly comes next, because then what Rabbi Akiva is saying isn't necessarily relevant.
Good, we'll get there. Okay. Let's just, right, so the reading that Tal is offering right now is we had one rule in the Mishnah which said everything depends on the personalities involved. Then we had a list of cases, and then we said in the rule, right, and those cases illustrate a general rule is that it all goes by the severity of the dignitary injury.
Call of practice, call of
the
elegant of prep.
Ah,
the Lobat. And I only got a Rabbi Akiva. One step at a time. I probably made that idiom up, didn't I?
Schwab?
Okay, right. My favorite of this sort is I still like my best translation of all time was I watched Superman in Israel about 20 years ago, and there was the explanation Mishkefe Shemesh Noraim Shel Elvis, which was translated in English phrase Great Shades of Elvis.
Oh.
Shades are supposed to be ghosts. And then they translated it as sunglasses. Like that's weird.
Crazy shades.
Okay.
So I was gonna suggest like Paul's reading, but in the language it really seems like it's hard to say in kvodo that it means the kvod like the kvod of the a sphira is some sort of kvod. I mean. It really does sound like he's talking about the person.
You want to say a kol lefi hakavod or a kol lefi.
It should be a kol lefi the decrease of kavod or whatever. This is what also I just did a quick search on the Bar Ilan and the other place where it says a kol lefi kvodo.
Oh, we'll get there, right? Yeah, in the Mekoreshit also.
Right, in Mekoreshit also then.
Okay, so
that's the only other place where it says a kol lefi kvodo.
No, there's three other places.
Or two other.
In the
Mishnah?
He's only talking about the Mishnah.
Oh, the Mishnah. Ah, okay.
The Mishnah only appears there.
Sure. Okay, Rob, what did you want to say?
I wanted to suggest what Tal said, that it's really referring back to the previous examples.
Okay, good. Janice, what do you want to say?
The fact that it's passed the right thing as well, does that sort of insinuate that there's things that aren't part of the club? Because it could have just omitted those words.
That call that to a body.
Yeah, I think that call actually should tell you that there are cases not previously mentioned. The rule usually, the way the Gemara understands that call, at least, is that call means that there is at least one other case not listed specifically that follows the same principle.
Right.
Right. So that's right. So, but according to Tal, every other case follows the same principle.
No. No, I think what Janice is asking is we don't know how to be.
You think there has to be Lemute also? I don't know there has to be limited just because it's a call. This is, could be a comprehensive rule. I'm not sure.
How do you evaluate when you bring actions into the account without talking about who it is?
Well, I don't know. Now we have to think.
How can you make that differentiate? How do you evaluate that? You can evaluate based on the person using these. So
that's the whole point.
So I think Tal wants to argue there's an objective standard
let's say, right, we could frame it this way, right? You have people get ranked from 1 to 100. Okay, right, these are people. Okay. And injuries get ranked from 1 to 100. Okay. Just imagine that as a fifth. To make it perfectly clear, we'll do it this way. Give it a fifth rank.
I only imagine you can't draw.
So Hakolah Vichodo tells us that all injuries are ranked on a scale of 1 to 100. And Hakolah Vichodo tells us here, all injuries are ranked on a scale of 1 to 100. And Hakolah Vichodo Mitpayesh, actually we need two different people here. We need the puncher and we need the punchy. Right? And the total amount you pay is produced by the matrix of these results. Right? If you commit an injury level 5, right? If you are a person level 20, you commit an injury, right? You commit an injury level 5 on a person of level 16, you pay X.
You know,
right?
Life comes down to
zero. How long that is a dungeon and dragon? okay, yeah, sure.
I think also, to a certain extent, we just need to establish somewhat of a baseline in terms of price, because when we're talking about Nezek, Ripoy, and Shevet, those are very, I mean, to simplify it, there's a monetary value that we could put in those things. Tsar and Boshet are much more complicated in terms of amount. So, like, I could personally feel how embarrassed I am, but to then turn that into a monetary equivalent is really complicated. So to a certain extent, I think that here we're establishing certain baselines. Like, okay, so this kind of level of embarrassment is about 200, and so now you can kind of...
Right.
But it's from there, because otherwise it's just totally random. Like, how do I know what that means?
That, I think, it's a perfectly reasonable way to set up a wall. Right? Is that, you know, that 1 to 100 is kind of extreme, so we know that this is the... Right, that, right, in terms of the injury, right? So we know that this is the punch of the nose level, and this is the slap with the open hand level, and this is the slap with the back of the hand level, and this is the tear off woman's head covering in public level. Right? But that's fine. And then that's how Commonwealth functions, right? So if somebody comes with a new injury, right, and they say, you know, he didn't do any of those things to me. What he did was he tweaked my nose. Right? So we say, well, it's tweaking your nose, like. Right, as opposed to trying to come up with a new amount for everything, which is really problematic, which is what drives tort law in America crazy now, right? Because every jury comes up with its own decision about how serious the injury was, and so you end up with people getting billions for having hot coffee spill on their lap, and $30 for having toxic waste that will destroy their procreative capacity forever, right? Depending on what first which, right? So that's perfectly reasonable. Right? The issue is whether we can plausibly get that into the words Hakol Lefi Chvodo, right? That Hakol Lefi Chvodo. What Hakol Lefi Chvodo means that everything depends on the severity of the injury, as opposed to it depends on the person, on the nature of the injury. Right? If we have to claim linguistically, right? And then we have to say that even though we go to all this effort to set up clear standards in terms of the injury, when it comes to the injurer and the injured, right, the tortfeasor and the victim, then all of a sudden we just say everything's up to the person, and there we have no standards at all. As of now, that's what we think, right? It's interesting that we care so much about defining the levels of the injuries and not so much about defining levels for the person. Now maybe we'll fix that, right? As we'll see, right, that the scheme that Tal is suggesting is Rabbi Shimon's scheme for the people. Right, set up two benchmarks. Okay, Rob, what do you want to say?
Just a question on the Hakol Lefi Mubayish and Mubayish. How do we do that math?
How do we do that math?
Yeah, how does that work? Let's say a level 20 person injures a level 50 person. Do you do, like, 20 times 100 minus 50? Is that how, like, how does...
You know, if I were doing it, I would say that, you know, that 50 is the median.
Yeah.
Right, and so we find out, right, so for the abstract person, you pay $100 for this, and then you pay, you know, then it's just by percentage. So a 20 person pays 40, a 20 person starts up at 40, now you're only up 40% of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're injuring an 80 person, right, so he has a bonus of 60%. So you multiply by right. So you multiply by two by you divide by two and multiply by three, and there you end up.
Yeah. Okay. I read it differently.
Okay. I this is all hypothetical, so we don't need to. Yeah, we can all set up your own mathematical schemes. You can do an inverse squares if you want.
I was reading the mivayish based on the kavana. Was the mechavein to mivayish, not mechavein?
Ah, you didn't write. You want to claim that.
And then the misvayish, that's a number scheme.
Aha. Okay, that's complicated. You want to claim the misvayish is not an issue of social status. It's an issue of intent, of severity of intent, and you get punished more as intent, right? As intent increases, and misvayish, that's a chiddush. We have to check that. It's like, I think generally, we hold that when it comes to Nezikin, intent is not relevant. Intent is only relevant for...
We saw that Boshet is only relevant if it's... we saw in the other sources that Boshet is only relevant if there was intent of Boshet, and not if there was no intent of Boshet.
Where did we see that?
That's in the...
that was because...
he falls off the roof and...
the issue, but that's not a question of intent. That's a question of... that's a misafe question.
I mean, it says miskaven.
Right.
It says miskaven in the language of miskaven.
Oh, it's just miskaven.
Okay. That could just be an up-and-down thing.
Right. Eino chayav al haboshet ad sheyehei miskaven.
Yeah, but once you are miskaven, then...
Right, that's what I'm assuming.
How would you even be able to, like... grade.
Not graded. These are miskaven.
Right. I think.
But that's the on-off switch, and then
the mivayish is a binary.
Hakol lefi is kind of like very broad language.
You have to have two things. You have to lefi hamivayish is to be miskaven, and lefi hamisvayish is for the amount.
You could be sharper. You could say hakol lefi mivayish is yes to have kavana, and hakol hamisvayish is yes to actually be embarrassed. And right, then they're both binary systems, and that's how you get the even like why vayishes arum is relevant. Okay, we can put it in the mix. I'm not convinced, but I can't. But if you set it up that way, I can't disprove it. Okay, David and Jeff.
So maybe this is how you were trying to push us with the indentation, but I could suggest that Zahakal is going back on all of the cases to Zahomer Hadami Bashor, because we go through. This is where the shore has, and this is what an Evid has, and then the last case is this is what Chavero gets. This is what Chavero has. So if all of this together is Hakal Lefi Kvodo.
What does Kavod have to do with anything, though?
Mm-hmm. When does an animal have
Kavod? A shore has the least Kavod, then an Eved, and then a Chavero. Who
has any Kavod? That's an assumption.
A shore has no Kavod. I don't care. You want to take no Kavod?
Okay.
A shore has no Kavod, and Eved has some Kavod, and Chavero has the most Kavod.
Sorry, I'm agnostic at this point. Janet, what do you
think? Take it out of context.
Let's not take that line out of context.
After log moment. Tala right now is suggesting it means the kavod valence of the action, right? Objectively, right? The kvodo is kvod amas. The kvodo really means the value of the loss of kavod, and the possessive refers to the action. And I would have my instinct would have been it meant the mitbayesh, but I
right,
agree.
So that my instinct is that it's not that when I first saw the Mishnah, I thought it was mitbayesh, but then after that, I thought it was taking the entire situation into account.
So the entire situation, meaning...
The person who's causing it.
So it's both the mivayesh and the mitvayesh, so it just
says
the same thing. So it says the same thing as, and the situation.
No,
so
that is the situation.
So what factors are included other than the mivayesh and the mitvayesh?
Intent.
So you want to put in a third thing. So you want to say this is a comprehensive thing, not it doesn't isolate the...
Right.
Doesn't isolate the action. Okay, I will maintain my... agnosticism. I'm not committed to any of these readings. Okay. So right now it seems that all of us have a bias towards trying to find some way to read all three statements as if they were part of one position, which makes sense because it's all anonymous and no one bothers to tell us it was a shift in speaker. Right?
Not necessarily limit what I was saying to back to the Mivayesh thing.
I think it could be worked in a certain way, but I wouldn't necessarily say that those two systems you set up over there are not independent and in conflict with each other.
Okay, good. So we have a bias, but we're not committed. We don't have to be committed to it. We can claim they're totally different, right? Oh, we could, if we were really atomistic, we would claim that there are three different positions, just the Zaklala is kind of left out in the limb that way, because there's no examples to relate to. Right, you could claim there's a position that says it all depends on this, and the position that says it all depends on, right, this is a kolofiyam yudayesh yudayesh, there's a position that it depends on this, which is a kolofiyam kodo, and then there's the examples, which are a claim that there's a system which is unchanging, which is entirely unchanging. Right, it's just, you define, right, you know, you just have rigid rules, and that's it, period. I could if I wanted to. I think I share the general bias. I understand what Tal is suggesting, that there's more of a bias towards connecting the last two than to connecting all three. Is that a fair way of framing it? Okay, good. You did it. What do you want? Sorry, Ron.
Klaus, I saw the soup. Kasha lagdi yodak kishach lelektio. Kiza odam koros elisha, nagid koros elisha. Ze bechlet meseleb, gam et ha-adam, nagid ha-migdar shelo, agenda shelo, וגם
חוטו של אדם כראש האישה. Ron wants to argue, it's an interesting claim, that para rosh ha'isha means that you cannot possibly believe that it is independent of person. I'm not sure, because you could claim that, you know, that the para rosh ha'isha is not the same asa at all, right? There's no busha at all. There's no such it's not variable by which woman, right? It's just the injury is only to a woman. It would be as absurd as saying if you commit an injury to a part of the anatomy that exists only on one gender and not the other, that demonstrates variability. This is an injury that can only happen to a woman. That's what I would think. But it's possible. I will leave it as a possible right. It doesn't convince me. Okay, Yedidi, what do you want to say?
Well, yeah, I mean, actually, I wasn't going to be so far away from what Ron just said.
Yeah.
Mostly, right, if anything, you could just take this as sort of evidence that maybe the Mishnah doesn't necessarily make such a hard and fast distinction between variable kavod based on variability of the action and variable kavod based on variability of the person, and just it's just sort of a general, all-encompassing statement saying that every case is different and every case is going to make different people.
Okay, I'm okay with that. All right, now we get to Rabbi Akiva. Okay, I'm Rabbi Akiva. Afilu aniim sheb Yisrael ro natam kilo heim b'nei Chorin sheyordim nisam sheim b'nei Avram Yitzchak v'Yaakov. All right, so Roy, how did you read that?
I read it as related to Zach Long.
Yeah.
Kol Tikvodo, even the Anim of Yisrael, no, rather, as the opposite of Kol Tikvodo.
Yeah.
Because I feel the Anim of Yisrael, you don't see them as a different type of person. You see them as any normal Jew, just, you know, they don't have as much money right now. How you read it related to what?
So, okay, let's try it again. So, if you were to rewrite Rabbi Akiva in your own words, right, not mentioning poverty or anything like that, in your own words, as simply as you can, what's Rabbi Akiva's rule?
Rabbi Akiva's rule that everybody is judged the same way regardless of their financial...
Okay, Rabbi Akiva's rule is that, economic condition is unrelated to, right, is not a factor determining amount of damages. Okay, that's a good first step. Now we have a second question, which is, how does Rabbi Akiva's rule relate to the previous thing in the Mishnah? So you said
it seems to be the
opposite of which line?
Kol Tikvodo.
But in order to say that, you have to read a Kol Tikvodo entirely differently, not the same way as Tal.
Right. You have to read a Kol Tikvodo depending on the.
So if you read a Kol Tikvodo as saying it depends on the person, so now, let's assume you read a Kol Tikvodo as depending on the person, because even if you don't read a Kol Tikvodo that way, we're reading a Kol Tikvodo Mavesha Mitbayesh that way.
Right.
So what you're saying, Rabbi Akiva, is contradicting that rule? What's the alternative?
You're saying that economics is not part of that quote.
Good.
Okay,
he's either contradicting that rule or he's limiting that rule.
Right.
So you're going to say, HaKol Lefi Chodo, or alternatively, HaKol Lefi HaMavyesh Meit Bayesh, but, right, Lefi Chodam Shel Eino Toloi B'Ramah HaEkonomi Shalom.
Kakali.
Calculi. Who knew? Madriga.
Economica means bleach.
I know. That one was on purpose. Okay. Tell me, what do you want to say?
Yeah, so I thought that it's possible that this statement of Rabbi Akiva is entirely independent of the context in the Mishnah.
Uh-huh.
I just said it like in a Shabbos rush or something like that. And the reason why it's being used here is because the real purpose, the real reason why we're getting Rabbi Akiva in is for the case with the woman and the Torah Shar, and since it fits in to some degree with this statement of Rabbi Akiva, so that statement was thrown in here too.
Good. I'm comfortable with him being literally independent, but still, does he mean what Roy said he means?
In other words, when I'm saying it's possible that it has absolutely nothing to do with...
You think it has nothing to do with bullshit at all?
No, he was just saying, every Jew, you know, is a wonderful person, and you're all children of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov.
So the editor of the Mishnah clearly thinks that it's related.
And Rabbi Akiva was not a good darshan, so... Halakha was his thing. He didn't make.
Oh, come on, you hold that Rabbi Shmuel. People
gave him grief for his accounting that six halakha or whatever, but he did.
All right. Adi, what do you want to say?
So b'nei chorin, and it's why if they're aniim, so we nitiches elem ke avadim. What's the avamina? I didn't understand it.
That is an excellent question. What does the term b'nei chorin mean here? David apparently has something to say about this.
Yeah, I think this exactly suggests my reading of the Halakhah of the that it's going back on all of the cases of Shor and Eved and then Chavero, that I might have had a Havamina that an Ani would be treated like an Eved. Come Rabbi Akiva and say, it says, no, it's only, Kavodo is only defined by objective personal status issues. You're either an Eved Tanani or you're Ben Yisrael, or you're a Goy, or whatever, but not by economic status within those categories.
Okay, you're assuming B'nai Chorin means free as opposed to slave.
Yeah.
I suspect that we may have, that we may be an archaeologist here, and that B'nai Chorin may mean something more precise than that, so that someone has to check that out. I've read this somewhere, but I can't answer your question properly. I should have looked it up before. My suspicion is that B'nai Chorin has a technical meaning that means something other than
landowner.
Yeah. I'm wondering if it doesn't mean something like
what's
I don't know. So there's somebody has to look at it. There's somebody looking at gesture now, but so we will suspend that for the moment while somebody at least does the gesture work, and if not, we'll find out. We'll find out afterwards. I should have done that in advance, and I failed to do that. It's my fault. Okay, Moshe and Elias.
I think the fact that it specifies that the B'nai Chorin that went down on their property, right? I think that's implying it's not just saying that everybody has equal economic status. It's not saying that they're considered like rich or that the rich are considered like poor. But I think rather the point that it's making is to go against the notion that if we think really, maybe it's setting the bar for Jews how low they can get. Where, you know, there can be poor people, unfortunately, even today, Kal v'chomer back then, where, you know, you can see some homeless people and they'll see a hot dog on the floor and they'll start beating each other up just for the dirty hot dog on the floor. That's how poor they get. But it's saying that for Jews, the bar doesn't get that low because they're sons of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, meaning they're not willing to stoop so low as to actually forego their honor of even being an Ish HaElokei, right? So they're not willing to actually do something so despicable, you know, where you might say like, alright, like you forced somebody to go to the bathroom in the middle of the street, you know, whereas, you know, unfortunately, you know, homeless people might do that in the middle of an alleyway, whereas a Jew is different.
Now, is that saying empirically Jews won't do that, or legally we refuse to acknowledge that Jews are like that?
I think legally we refuse to acknowledge it, and empirically most of the time, although yes, maybe there are exceptions, but, you know, batel l'rov, where, you know, because Jews follow Allah, that's a moral law, and, you know, where we see ourselves as B'Tselem Elohim, so we won't stoop to that low. Whereas, that's a tougher qualification, because it could be that those attributes, you know, still have been passed down to see ourselves as on a higher level than rather just needing to cater to our own base needs. Rather, we need to cater to something higher than our natural instincts and be, No, I would say probably it gets passed down, even in a not frum
society. I probably, you know, I don't have your empirical faith, but I don't think, I doubt it will work out to be true, but...
You doubt that what, which part of that will work out?
That actually it's that much harder to get Jews to do things that they're sitting in other people.
I think you would need to look at homeless Jews and...
Yeah, you'd have to do it. It's interesting. I don't
and
have that,
look, the homeless... I have limited experience with homeless people, but I will say that, you know, when I did volunteer at a homeless shelter in Eretz Yisrael, that the people had much more dignity than the homeless I've come into contact with in America. And that might sound biased, and I'm sure it is biased somewhat, but I think there must be something there to the extent that, you know, still they feel the need to cling on to some kind of higher value than just saying, all right, I need to survive. And yes, obviously case by case, but I think as a general principle.
Could be. I don't have the empirical faith, even though I share your experience. You know, I just don't know. I don't know that. I don't know that I would attribute it to that. But I can't defaultify it. I have to do the research. It's a cool research project. Okay, Rory, what do you want to say?
Why can't it simply be the case that the accumulated knowledge of the rule is a kolzi kodo, that everything would be in accordance with people's honor, but that Rabbi Akiva then believes that everybody has equal honor?
That's fine. You can explain, so then the rule is meaningless in that sense.
Right, I mean, it's sort of like his block on the rule. Like, okay, so the rule is honor, but I see that everybody,
okay, that's
everybody
fine.
Has equal honor.
That's fine. Practically, right, he disagrees with whatever the person who said the rule meant legally. Right, even though, if you ask at a broad abstract level, right, Odessa would be happy because they don't really argue about it in principle. Okay, let's move in one point with this background, which is, Deirdre, what is something worth?
Is something worth?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it kind of depends on a lot of different things.
No.
Like, an object is worth what it's worth.
Right. How much is a book worth?
It's worth as much as we think it's worth.
Whatever
is
the
worth.
Whatever society is
worth. You're worth
it.
That's just in economics. If I know someone that'll pay $3,000 for this book, does that mean that this book is worth $3,000? I don't know. Like,
apparently. What else would it mean?
If someone offers pay $50, then it's worth $50 and $3,000, then how could
so
it
is.
Be worth both?
Good. So it's bad. This is what the issue with poor people and bullshit is. It doesn't necessarily, right, you know, poor people, it doesn't necessarily mean that poor people have less dignity, right? It means that, right, you always have the issue, right, let's say, you know, this is the whole issue of Hazahav, right? If we say, yesterday I could buy 3 chumashim for a gemara, but today I trade gemara and chumashim even up, does that mean that that chumashim have gotten more valuable? Right, or gemara has gotten less valuable, if we had, right, an inflation or a deflation? So the question is, when we say that the bullshit, that the payment for the bullshit of poor people is less, does that mean it's because poor people have less dignity, or money is worth more to poor people?
So I mean, I was actually just about to ask, you know, when we're saying hakoloti kvodo, and we're translating it as honor. I think one person translated it as bullshit, but, you know, are we defining that as dignity on some sort of moral or human level, or are we saying kvodo that's some money? Like, you know, a person's honor is by how much they're worth in points.
So, okay, good. So I want to say that one of the issues going here is that it will always be the case that rich people can spend more money to avoid dignitary injuries than poor people. Right. So let's say, right, if I walk up to a rich person and I say, right, how much would you pay to avoid having a pious run in your face? And the answer is $1 million. And I walk over to a poor person and I say, how much would you avoid having a pious run in your face? And the answer is $10. That way it looks like the rich person has much more honor than the poor person. But if I walk over to somebody and I say, and I say to them, how much money are you willing to leave yourself with in order to avoid having a pie thrown in your face? Right? And the rich person says, well, I would spend down to my last 10 million. And the poor person says, I would spend down to my last 100.
Right? So it turns out that the poor person has more dignity. Right? Because the poor person is willing to leave himself with less to avoid this. Right? Than the rich person is. Right? So it's all right, it's all a question of framing. So one of the issues going on here is, are we willing to allow dignity to float? Right, to the point where the most impoverished people, even if they are intrinsically the most dignified people, right, are much more vulnerable to harm. Because it costs nothing. Right, it costs nothing to humiliate them. Right, that's a really important social